afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. Our final case set for today is case number 68849. Is it Abate? Abate versus Ace Cab. Mr. Wunder, Ms. Millifolk, Mr. Trimmer, and Ms. Trotter. Counsel, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Justices, and may it please the Court. I would like to reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. My name is Christina Militovich, and I'm here with the Law Office of Dan Wunder on behalf of the 240 former Prius employee taxi cab drivers. Mainly, today's case is about unemployment benefits. We will get into certain concerns of labor in this, but the main point of this case is to decide whether the 240 tax cab driver claimants are entitled to their unemployment benefits. Having said that, at the outset, I would like to state that striking in itself is not illegal. The NLRA protects workers' right to strike lawfully. States may pay striking employees even if the strike is illegal unemployment benefits. So today, we ask you to decide, as an issue of first impression, in Nevada, whether a labor dispute must be union authorized on labor's end. We also ask you to find that there is not substantial evidence on record that the claimants committed disqualifying misconduct that wouldn't entitle them to unemployment benefits.
Let me ask you this. Pursuant to the statute and my understanding was that the board made a decision indicating that 612385 misconduct statute applied and not 612395. But where in that statute, this is how it reads, a person disqualified for benefits for any week with respect to which the administrator finds that the person's total or partial unemployment was due to a labor dispute in active progress. Why wasn't this a labor dispute?
Mrs. Perigary, this was not a labor dispute, as the appeals referee reasoned and as the Board of Review adopted, because for a labor dispute to occur, the union members must be working under the authority of the union.
Who says? You didn't cite any authority for that.
Well, we believe that because NRS 612-385 is governed and is implemented by Employment Security Division, it is a statute that they administer, their reading of it is entitled to deference. And so since the appeals referee found, due to very reasonable factors, that labor disputes have to be union sanctioned, that ruling is entitled to deference. He based his decision on at least the following five factors. The number one factor is the union did not authorize the activity of the claimants. Number two, claimants' angst was directed at the union rather than the employer, making this, that is uncharacteristic of a labor dispute, according to the chief appeals referee. Number three, he determined that the claimants would have only been disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits until they abandoned labor's ends. And in the Four Queens case from 1989, this honorable court found that labor's ends are the union ends. At least that was in the dicta of that case. So it wouldn't necessarily make sense to view collective bargaining as between anyone besides the union and the employer.
But doesn't Airport Casino Incorporated suggest that we should view labor dispute more broadly than that?
Airport Casino has a very general definition of labor dispute that's taken from the Norris LaGuardia Act as well as the NLRA. And New York Telephone versus New York Department of Labor found that the Social Security Act and the NLRA were both enacted in 1935, and they were conceived to coexist. So in that case, where a strike was illegal, they found that unemployment benefits still could be paid. And the states are free to set up their unemployment schemes in the way that they see fit. The NLRA does not mandate states to not pay striking employees unemployment benefits. It's up to each state. And so we go back to the appeals referee's reasoning and then the adoption of that reasoning by the Board of Review to find that Nevada's agency that's in charge of implementing and enforcing the unemployment compensation statute, they're saying that in Nevada, for a dispute to be considered under the labor dispute qualification, it must be union authorized. Another factor that the appeals referee found for reasoning as to why this is not a labor dispute is because there is no evidence on record that the claimants continue to try to negotiate returns with the CBA. They were merely protesting an action that they reasonably found to be illegal by their union and the employer to some extent, because the employer also signed the CBA without a ratification vote. And without getting very deeply into the analysis of NRS 614.170, I like to say that whether that statute is preempted by federal law doesn't necessarily concern us for the purposes that we're here to discuss today. Because even if the claimants had a reasonable, good faith error, they could still be qualified pursuant to the disqualification statute, the misconduct disqualification statute, and they can still receive unemployment.
But again, isn't one of the policies here the cause of their unemployment was due to their choice to leave the job? And this was contrary to three letters that were sent by the union representative, right?
Yes, sir. They did consciously not come to work, but the analysis for the disqualification statute isn't whether they deliberately chose not to come to work. It's whether they deliberately disregarded a reasonable expectation that their employer had the right to expect. And so that analysis...
Can you say that again?
It's a separate analysis of whether conduct warrants termination versus whether conduct disqualifies claimants from receiving unemployment benefits. And that's according to the Clark County versus Bundley line of cases, the Nevada Supreme Court cases. There has to be an element of wrongfulness in the conduct to disqualify claimants from receiving unemployment.
And where do you find that?
An element of wrongfulness is in...
And the district court specifically found that wasn't the case, correct?
The district court, it is our position that the appeals referee did not make a finding based on substantial evidence that the employees disregarded a reasonable expectation of the employer. And we also, it is our position that whether claimants willfully disregarded.
But didn't the district court find contrary to that, and in fact cited Bundley for that, the exact opposite conclusion?
Yes, and
that there doesn't need to be malevolent intent in order to be disqualified.
Well, actually, I have to look back at the order specifically to see exactly what you're referencing, but the Kolnick case of 1996 states that misconduct warranting termination and misconduct warranting denial of unemployment benefits are two separate issues. And so it is our position that while claimant's termination could arguably be warranted in this instance, the appeals referee did not, with substantial evidence, find that the expectation the employer had was reasonable. The claimants...
In what sense?
So, in this scenario, the union and the employers submitted a last, best, and final CBA draft. They presented that to a vote. Out of the 800 members that voted, out of the 700 members that voted, 686 of them voted against signing the CBA. That is a 98% rejection rate. 1,200 employees were eligible to vote. So 686 out of 1,200 would still make the majority of those eligible to vote show that they do not want the CBA in effect. So the employers were aware that the majority of their union members did not want to ratify the CBA. The CBA itself, that was signed contrary to the wishes of the union membership, Article 35, which is the no strikes, no lockouts provision, does not, by its terms, apply to conduct that is not the strikes that are called. It only applies to strikes that are called by the union, not to strikes called by the union members themselves. And this is shown because Section 1 of Article 35 has the understanding that the union and the employer have that taxi cab companies need to graciously continue service, but then it states that the union itself agrees not to call strikes. It does not say the union and the individual members. And in the contract itself, there are other instances where the union is differentiated from the individual members. In fact, in Section 3 in Article 35, it states that the union nor any individual members shall honor any picket line. In this case, the claimants called a protest. They were not honoring a protest.
In this case, was a vote required by the union members to ratify the contract?
I'm sorry?
Was a vote required to ratify?
According to the terms of the CBA, no. According to the terms of the Constitution of the Union, no. But the claimants reasonably believe that NRS 614.170 required that a ratification meeting take place and that they should have been allowed to see a draft.
If the Constitution and I guess the bylaws, as you said, say they don't have to have a ratification vote, what's their good faith belief?
I don't believe that the Constitution says that they don't have to. It just doesn't speak to it. But there are many laws that kind of deal with labor that states are free to implement, such as the prohibition against child labor and things like that.
But that's part of the crux. You have two different arguments. One is good faith belief of their actions of striking and a good faith belief as to the ratification. And I'm just trying to find out or figure out what the premise is for the belief as to either one or both of their acts.
Well, before claimants came to us, to our firm, they already knew of the statute, 614.170. So they read that statute, and in that statute, it references a meeting that is to take place, rather than a meeting that might take place. So even if they got the interpretation of the statute wrong, they still had a good faith belief that their union and their employer colluded to illegally force them into the CBA after they clearly stated that they did not want any part of it. And so, in addition to all of that, the claimants did have a good cause to quit based on this reasonable belief in the statute and the contract being void, as well as the no strikes Article 35 not prohibiting the conduct to which they participated. They did not violate any provision, any section of the no strikes article. And so there really is no reason with substantial evidence on the record why they should be disqualified from receiving unemployment. The Supreme Court has explained in New York Telephone that, well, in Airport Casino, this court stated that the state wants to remain neutral in labor disputes. In New York Telephone, the Supreme Court stated that there is no injustice done to the state's desire to want to stay neutral if they do pay unemployment benefits to even illegally striking workers. In this case, we still maintain that the strike and that the work stoppage was not illegal. Because in order for a work stoppage to be illegal, it would have to be in contravention of a CBA, and yeah. It's not.
Where do you see that? And tell me where your support for that is again.
So respondents actually cited to the Emporian Capital case. I'm sorry, the case that I was referencing before is New York Telephone versus New York Department of Labor. And that case stands for the proposition that states may pay benefits to even illegal strikers, and they came to this determination from reading the legislative history of the Social Security Act and the NLRA. They stated that neither statute mentioned the effects of paying unemployment benefits having any sort of effect on the bargaining process that would affect the free play of economic forces that the federal law is trying to maintain in regards to collective bargaining. And in that case, there was a nationwide union sanctioned strike. So it was found to be illegal. And then in the Baker versus GMC case, the Supreme Court in 1986 stated that Section 7 of the NLRA did not preempt a state's ability to pay unemployment benefits to strikers. So it is our main position that the respondents haven't presented a reason why claimants should have been denied unemployment.
Can I ask you a question again? I know you're trying to reserve some time, but again, the court focused on 612.385 and 612.395, misconduct and labor dispute as to the definitions. And we specifically, this court specifically has addressed what constitutes misconduct, so to speak, in the Murphy case. And are you familiar with that case?
I'm not.
Okay. And that basically indicated that unemployment compensation in Nevada is designed to ease the economic burden on those who are unemployed through no fault of their own. Now, there's an indication in the record that they knew what the possible consequences of this strike would be. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. They knew that they could potentially be terminated.
Right.
But they did not know that they could rightfully be terminated.
But again, that case that I just mentioned stands for the proposition that it applies to those that are unemployed through no fault of their own. I'm trying to reconcile.
Well, we believe that the claimants in this case, there is no element of wrongfulness here. So they thought that their union and their employer signed a contract which they would have to work under, but that contract was illegally entered into. And so they were protesting. And
isn't that a labor dispute?
No.
And doesn't that disrupt the employer?
They became unemployed when the employer terminated them, not when they started the work stoppage. And the employer terminated them, as the appeals referee found, for violations of a CBA, not for participating in a labor dispute. They were terminated for specific provisions of the CBA. That's why the interpretation of Article 35 is very important in this instance. And there is an NLRB case, Silver State Disposal, in which the NLRB interprets a no-strikes provision that's almost identical to the one in this case. And they find that that provision does not prevent the individual members from stopping work. And so we believe that our Article 35 is entitled to the same interpretation.
Okay, thank you.
You have about 11 and a half minutes left. Did you want to reserve some time or you want to add some more?
May I reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal?
Well, you've only got 11 minutes and 18 seconds left.
Okay.
Mr. Trimmer, on behalf of the respondent.
Yes, and I plan on taking 15 minutes.
I'm sure the court would appreciate that.
Good afternoon, Justices and Chief Justice. Paul Trimmer for the employers. From our perspective, there are two issues to consider. First, whether the claimant's participation in a wildcat strike disqualified them from unemployment benefits pursuant to 395's labor dispute disqualification. And second, whether participation in a wildcat strike would also constitute disqualifying misconduct within the meaning of 612.385. I will focus on the first issue, the labor dispute disqualification, as well as a few other arguments that the petitioners have made that relate to that issue, including this discussion about 614.170, the interpretation of the no-strike clause, and a few other issues. With respect to the labor dispute issue, from our perspective, the best place to start is with this court's precedent, because it has already given definition to that phrase in Airport Casino versus Jones. And there was a question about whether it was broad or vague or something like that. The court in Airport Casino versus Jones made it very clear that the definition it was giving to labor dispute in that case was intentionally broad. It was adopting the meaning of labor dispute under that's in the North LaGuardia Act and in the National Labor Relations Act, and that quote includes any controversy concerning wages, hours, working conditions, or terms of employment. And I would note, and this is addressed in a footnote in our brief, but the definition of labor dispute in the North LaGuardia Act, which is 29 U.S.C. 113C, as well as the definition in the National Labor Relations Act, which is 29 U.S.C. 152A, makes it very clear that a union is not required. A labor dispute under both of those statutory schemes can exist even in the absence of an employment relationship between the employees who are engaging in the dispute and the employer. And that necessarily eliminates the involvement of a union. And that's one of the first reasons why, in our view, the division's decision, the referee's decision after the initial appeals hearing, was contrary to this court's decision in Airport Casino versus Jones. And as set forth in our brief, while agencies are entitled to discretion in many situations, they are not entitled to deference when interpreting and applying this court's decisions.
Counsel, as I ask the other side, I come back to this. What constitutes misconduct? And good faith errors in judgment or discretion do not constitute misconduct. And that's the Bunley case as well as the Colnick case.
Yes.
So why is there relief? They seem not to believe that the contract, the action was valid. And they also felt that they were properly entitled to strike.
And I think you mentioned earlier when you were questioning the petitioner's counsel that the way it was articulating its defense to the disqualification, to the misconduct disqualification, was conflating the labor dispute issue. And I think that that's important here. Under the labor dispute disqualification, the court in Airport Casino and Jones made it very clear that it wants the state to remain neutral in labor disputes, to not make any decisions, to not engage in fact-finding related to whether a person had a reasonable belief that might justify them for walking off the job.
Well, that's not quite the way the case law sums it, because you're almost saying good faith belief, they're not going to take a position, but you gave them a position. So, is this misconduct or not? Did they have a good faith or a reasonable belief to do what they're doing? And that's what I'm looking for. Whether or not, your words in terms of this.
Sure. So from our perspective, to the extent the labor dispute disqualification applies, their good faith belief, whether they possessed it or not, is irrelevant. To the extent that you look at this case under 385 and the labor dispute disqualification, or the misconduct disqualification, we believe they did not have a good faith belief for a number of reasons. First, my colleague, counsel for the division, will get into this in more detail when she's speaking. But from our perspective, the union made it very clear to these individuals that if they walked off the job and engaged in a wildcat strike, they would be terminated. And they would lose their jobs, and the union would not be able to defend them because the strike would be unprotected. See, ordinarily, an economic strike, which happens in negotiations, or perhaps an unfair labor practice strike, where a union calls a strike to protest an employer's unlawful actions, an employee has a reasonable expectation that they'll likely return to their job at the conclusion of that economic strike or at the conclusion of that unfair labor practice strike. Now, in the context of an economic strike, they can be replaced, but they're still entitled to some form of preferential reinstatement. In a wildcat strike situation like this, the employees knew that the claimants knew when they walked off the job that they were violating the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, at least within the from the perspective of the employer and the union, and that they were putting their employment at risk, and they had no expectation of returning to it. There was no doubt that this strike was not protected, and that's relevant to whether or not you should give any consideration to this claim that they had a reasonable belief. This strike was contrary to the contract, and it was unlawful. It was not protected by law. And I think an important thing to realize here is what the adopting the petitioner's view interpretation of the statute would require. It would mean that although this court has found that employees who engage in a lawful strike are not entitled to unemployment benefits, and although this court has found that employees who are locked out in an offensive lockout by an employer, so through no fault of their own, but because the employer wishes to take a strong economic position, locks the employees out and doesn't let them come to work. Both of those cases have come before this court, and in both occasions, the court said they're not entitled to benefits. If you adopt the petitioner's position in this case, it would elevate employees who engage in a unlawful wildcat strike that undermines their union and their employer. It would give them benefits and not give employees that are complying with their union's rules and regulations, and give employees who are engaging in lawful activity, they would be denied benefits. But the claimant's position would award them to employees who are engaging in repugnant behavior, behavior that is against the public policy of the state. Now, from our perspective, putting aside the Employment Security Division's attempt to put a gloss on Airport Casino versus Jones, the factual conclusions that the referee reached conclusively established that this was in fact a labor dispute, that it was a controversy concerning wages, hours, working conditions. These individuals picketed. They went on strike. They knew that if they went on strike by virtue of the union's communications that they were putting their employment in jeopardy. They interfered with the company's business activities throughout the Las Vegas Valley, interfering with the cab's attempt to pick up passengers outside the Wynn, outside the convention center, downtown. They even picketed Ms. Frias' home, massing outside her driveway, shouting at her with a bullhorn. That is a labor dispute. And that activity, in one form or another, continued all the way through the unemployment hearing that took place in this case in July 2013. Now, the petitioner's counsel has euphemistically referred to this classic strike activity as a protest. But as you heard in her presentation, the goal was to protest the collective bargaining agreement, contest its validity, and somehow force the union and the companies to go back to the table and renegotiate a contract that the claimants liked better. That was futile, and they should have realized that. No individual could have a good faith belief that that would actually work. But more importantly, it establishes that it was a labor dispute. And forcing the ESD into a position where it has to evaluate the subjective beliefs of 300 claimants who just engaged in a mass wildcat strike would be an administrative nightmare. And it's contrary to the neutrality principle that's articulated in Airport Casino versus Jones and was first articulated in the 1954 decision, D. Paoli versus Ernst. Address NRS 614-170 and it's applicable to this case. During the petitioner's presentation, it wasn't clear if they were continuing to take the position that NRS 614-170 invalidated the collective bargaining agreement or not. From our perspective, that issue has been settled. If nothing else, the NLRB ruled that the strike was unlawful, not protected by the Act, and the Federal District Court ruled that 614-170 was preempted, and while that decision is only persuasive on this court, I think the reasoning in Judge Gordon's decision is persuasive. But to the extent that the petitioner was taking the position that their subjective interpretation of 614.170 established that they had a reasonable belief that would entitle them to participate in a wildcat strike. We couldn't disagree more. Again, the point of the labor dispute disqualification is to ensure neutrality, to ensure that the state is not involved in making decisions about what's reasonable or not. Intrinsic in any decision about reasonability is a value judgment. The state unemployment division shouldn't be making value judgments about whether one strike is good and whether another strike is bad, whether one lockout is good and another lockout is bad. They shouldn't be evaluating the party's bargaining positions and whether it was reasonable or not for an employee to walk off the job. The idea is that that should be left to the parties to work out in bargaining and left out to the NLRB if any activity is unlawful, because that's the agency that has primary jurisdiction over labor, unfair labor practice allegations. But to the extent that the division is involved, it should not be giving unemployment benefits to employees or individuals which might prop up and extend a labor dispute.
Doesn't that depend upon each individual, whether or not they've abandoned the strike now, they want to go back to work? I mean, why can't we apply 395 as written? Why harmonize that for me with the findings under 385?
Right. That's a good point. I think the court did that in Fort Queens, and the reason it was able to do so in Fort Queens was because the nature of the strike in that case was fundamentally different than the strike here. The strike in Fort Queens was an economic strike, where the employees left work to put pressure on the employer. Under the National Labor Relations Act, that economic strike, those employees are protected. Their employment relationship is never severed. They have a right to reinstatement upon the conclusion of the economic strike, or if the employer has exercised its right to replace them, these employees would then have a right to preferential reinstatement. They go on a preference list. But that's the important distinction in why that mode of analysis can't be harmonized with this case. This case is a wildcat strike. This case, the employees knew when they walked off the job and participated in a strike, they were choosing to end their employment relationship at that time. It's a very, in terms of the plain meaning of, is someone unemployed due to a labor dispute? That's exactly what happened. Due to a labor dispute, these employees walked off the job and chose to participate in a wildcat strike. The consequences are more severe than it would be in a lawful economic strike, but that's the choice that was made. It can't be harmonized in this situation because of the facts.
But this court's never held that the union has to authorize the strike in order to be a labor dispute like we're discussing.
That's exactly right. And for our position would be that the court's prior decisions, beginning with DPAOLE versus Ernst and ending with Airport Casino versus Jones, would be contrary to that, because it's given a very expansive interpretation to the phrase labor dispute. I want to address one other item that I think might require clarification. It's not briefed in a great detail, and that is the discussion about New York Telephone. That case, we have a different interpretation of what that case, a different reading than petitioners do. That case involved whether or not the National Labor Relations Act preempts all state unemployment codes. And if you read that decision carefully, the U.S. Supreme Court concluded that it's absolutely the case that the availability of unemployment compensation has an impact on labor disputes. But they found that impact, and it would be preempted by the NLRA, but for the fact that the Social Security Act and the NLRA were enacted at the same time. And so the Supreme Court harmonized those two statutes and assumed that the U.S. Congress would allow for the availability of unemployment compensation and not have it be preempted by the NLRA simply because of the circumstances of those statutory schemes enacted, not because it was making a decision about whether unemployment benefits should be awarded or not. And A.G. Baker, the Michigan case from 1986, is the same. It specifically provides that the availability of unemployment benefits has an impact on labor disputes, but it's nonetheless not preempted, because under New York Telephone, the two schemes were adopted at the same time. And with that, unless you have any other questions, I cede the time to my colleague.
Mr. Carter.
Good afternoon, Justices, Chief Justice and Counsel. My name is Lori Trotter. I represent Employment Security Division, and I will be discussing three issues, and I'm hoping that it'll address some of the questions that we were posed earlier to Council, the voluntary quit exception and the good cause, the issue of whether misconduct took place, and the good cause discussion in that respect, and also whether or not any exceptions apply to misconduct. And I need to grab my glasses. So I'll briefly talk about the voluntary quit and good cause. And it wasn't mentioned specifically in the opening brief, but in the reply, the claimants contended that they voluntarily quit and they had good cause for doing so, pursuant to NRS 612.380. Claimants cannot show and they cannot meet their burden of proof that they voluntarily quit with good cause. Good cause is specifically defined, is not specifically defined in statute, but the Board of Review generally holds that good cause can be established if claimant had no inherent, if claimant had no alternative but to quit. They can establish a good cause, but their reasons must be so compelling, a reasonably prudent person would voluntarily give up gainful employment and join the ranks of the unemployed. Or they also must show that they acted in good faith with a reasonable desire to retain their employment. And they claimants also have to show that they exhausted all reasonable alternatives before quitting.
In this case, though, we don't have a voluntary quit, though we have a voluntary position if they felt that they had a valid labor dispute.
Right, but
why
I wanted
is that not good cause?
Justice Douglas, I wanted to address this issue because there's a couple of good cause.
I understand, but I'm not tracking with what you're giving me because it's outside the scope of this fact situation. So coming back to this fact situation, we don't have them voluntarily quitting, at least that's their position.
I agree
so
with you.
We
I
have
agree with you
that a good cause as wasn't to whether it's a
I agree with you that they did not have good cause for voluntary quitting, but what they have done is admitted that they deliberately left the workplace. And so that's a fact that's established, and there can be no dispute of fact because they included
that
in
they might phrase it, they voluntarily went on a strike to protest the contract.
Well, they in their brief, they put it in terms of NRS 612.380, which is the voluntarily quit, and they said they had good cause for doing so. So I wanted just to address that issue. And then in them bringing up that issue, they also admit that they deliberately walked off the job. So they made an informed decision to walk off the job. And then as far as the misconduct, I'd like to address that. So the Fremont Hotel case discusses misconduct, and their definition is any improper or wrong conduct. And the Bundy case gives us a lot more information as far as the definition of misconduct. And so first, there's in order to show misconduct, there has to be a deliberate, unjustifiable violation or disregard of the reasonable standards of conduct that an employer has a right to expect, or carelessness or negligence to such a degree to show a substantial disregard of employer's interests or employee's duties to the employer. And there must be also an element of wrongfulness, and those are all described in the Bundy case.
And Bundy also says good faith errors in judgment or determination do not constitute misconduct.
I will get into that. I wanted to address that specifically because there is an exception carved out for when there's a good faith situation. The Fremont Hotel talked about the element of wrongfulness, and it says that the element of the wrongfulness is defined as contrary to the manner in which a reasonable employer has a right to expect. And as counsel previously mentioned, it's not based on the subjective intent of the claimant. It's based on whether a reasonable employer had a right to expect from an employee. And that's set forth in the Natchev case. So as far as misconduct, the claimants acted improperly and wrongfully when they deliberately walked off the job against the employer's policy. In this case, it was the collective bargaining agreement. And the collective bargaining agreement was reasonable because it had a no strikes and no work stoppage policy. It was reasonable because the union members voted on it in the past. It was a known policy in place for many years, this no strikes, no work stoppage. It had been established by past practice. It had been relied upon the union and the employees for years. And then it was voted again in this new collective bargaining.
And you just said they had a reasonable belief that it was something they voted on in the past. And that seems to be the center, the epic point in this dispute. They said, they're saying it wasn't valid because they didn't get to vote. It was just signed.
Right, so that if the contract's not valid, then the former contract is in place, right? So by past practice, the former contract would still be in place, which that term was in there, that there would be no work stoppages. So going forward with that application of misconduct, work stoppage was a violation of the collective bargaining unit. The claimants all received warnings from the union 3 different times in writing. They were warned that the work stoppage would violate the collective bargaining unit, collective bargaining agreement. The claimants knowingly violated that collective bargaining unit despite those warnings. They deliberately violated the agreement, and their protest or their strike was pre-planned. It was continued on for many, many days, despite the risk of discharge. And the work stoppage, which started on the 29th of March, they did not immediately report to work for 3 days, and that was from Saturday to Wednesday before there was a discharge. The element of wrongfulness applies here because the basic foundation of employment is that employee shows up for work when it's their shift. It's the basic foundation of, you know, of an employment relationship. Here, they engaged in a work stoppage. It was contrary to the manner in which an employer had the right to expect. And the claimants created a chaotic situation for the union. They created a chaotic situation for the employers. They created a chaotic situation for their fellow employees that didn't get involved in that strike, and for, you know, the customers of the taxi cabs. And also they created an economic hardship for the union. Now, the exceptions that you described earlier are just mentioned in the...
But, Ms. Trotter, what's the economic hardship for the union? Because the union informed them...
I'm sorry. If I said union, I apologize. I meant for the employer.
Okay, sorry.
I apologize. I keep saying union, and so sometimes I get my tongue tied there. Apologize. So the Colnick case carved out some exceptions for when misconduct does not apply. And those are also, I think, discussed in Bundley as well. So misconduct does not apply when there's ordinary negligence, when it's an isolated instance, or a good faith error in judgment or discretion. I think that's what you were getting to. And in this case, those exceptions, ESD believes, do not apply to the situation. This was not an ordinary situation of negligence because the claimants were warned 3 times by the union in writing, don't strike. It's a violation of collective bargaining unit. It's illegal. And if you strike, or if you engage in a work stoppage, you'll be fired or you won't be protected. So you're risking your job if you engage in a strike. That was written, 3 different letters were provided to the claimants. And also Mr. Hickman's testimony described that, and that was on page 84, 88, and 90 of his transcript. It was not ordinary negligence because it was contrary to the previous collective bargaining unit if the current one wasn't valid. And it's also just by the basic foundations of common law employment, employment law, and an employee shows up to work when they're supposed to, when their shift is set up. This was not ordinary negligence because there was a knowledge of the risk of discharge. As I mentioned earlier, Mr. Tesima testified on JA 309 and 310. He admitted that he knew that there was a risk of discharge if they engaged in this protest and work stoppage. An ordinary prudent employee would have heeded the warnings of their union if they cared about their job. This was not a situation of misunderstanding or mistake. It was a concerted plan in advance They planned on March 27th to strike on March 29th, according to Mr. Tessima's testimony. The claimants ignored the advice of their union and they knowingly risked their jobs. Mr. Tessima also admitted in the ESD questionnaire when he was asking for benefits that he would not return to work if it was immediately offered. So the first situation about ordinary negligence does not apply. The second exception to misconduct is that it was not an isolated instance. These were multiple and continuing acts over a period of time. The work stopped, the taxi cab driver stopped work early on the 29th of March 2013. They drove back to the yard and they turned in their cars. And then after that, they went to the picket lines and they immediately formed the picket lines. And they refused to work for multiple days. Not just one day, not just that first day. They continued every day to make a decision, I'm not going to come to work today. There were multiple and continuing acts and they were documented by the employer. And there's a large discussion about that documentation in the testimony during the administrative hearing. They were continuing to picket for months. And up until the administrative hearing date, which was the 11th and 12th of July, they were continuing to picket on that day. So it wasn't just a one-day thing, it was a multiple-day thing, and it went into the month of July. And according to JA page 216, there were some claimants that, or not, sorry, there were some employees that realized they made a mistake. They were engaged in the picketing and the striking, and they didn't come to work. And they heeded those letters, and they realized they made a mistake. They came back to work, and according to Mr. Hickman, if they returned to work by the 3rd of April, they got the jobs back. And there was about approximately 20 that got their jobs back. Those who realized they made a mistake were able to get their jobs back if they decided within a reasonable amount of time. And that was between the 29th and the 3rd. So the second exception does not apply because this was not an isolated instance. It was an ongoing thing for months. And the third exception does not apply because this is not a good faith error in judgment. They were warned in writing by their union for three different times. Some of those members really heeded that advice and they came back to work and they got their jobs. They knew the risk of discharge, according to Mr. Tessima, page JA 309 and 310. They knew the risk of discharge when they participated, yet they continued to participate. It was knowing and willful, it was deliberate, and they knew it was a violation of the collective bargaining agreement with their employer. Mr. Tessima stated that they were striking because they wanted to show, they're striking against the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, but they were also unhappy with their employer and with that contract. They knew that they were operating outside of the union policy and out of compliance with the union. The union instructed them to go back to work. We need to go back to work. We didn't vote on this. You could get fired. And they pleaded with these claimants to come back to work, and they refused to do so. And then Mr. Tessima admitted that he authored the letter found on JA page 342. We went on strike to demand justice. Sorry, quote is, we went on a wildcat strike to demand justice, which he knew what he was doing. This is not a good faith error in judgment. They knew it was contrary to what the union had instructed them to do, and they continued to do it. The claimants cannot show that the misconduct was justified. They were instructed about what the law was. They were instructed they could lose their jobs. They continued to risk their jobs and participated in the situation.
This was by their own union.
Yes.
And so basically their gripe was with their own union.
Correct. Their union said, guys or gals, we need to get you guys back to work. The union did not vote on this. This is contrary to what you should do. It's illegal.
Rather than a strike that disrupts the employer's operation, what recourse do they have to challenge a union decision?
They can file grievances. And they did so, I think. I think Mr. Winder, in his testimony, actually mentioned, not, he didn't testify, but he mentioned that that a grievance had been filed. So there are other recourses. There is other recourse other than a strike to voice their concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nevada legislature passed 16.170. And they passed it for a very important reason. And we probably should go back and understand the backdrop of what was going on in 1985. In fact, the Clark County District Attorney's Office had a task force in place to stop organized crime. There was also lots of union misconduct back in the 1980s and 1970s. There had been misuse of trust funds. There had been allegations of organized crime controlling unions. There had been union bosses that did things without the membership's approval. But the state of Nevada and their legislature said in 1985, not only are we having Don Campbell was part of that special task force that was going after organized crime back in 1985 and in the early 80s, but we are also going to protect our citizens. We are going to protect our citizens by simply requiring that union bosses cannot make a decision on their own without the membership's participation. That in no way goes against or supersedes the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, isn't that particularly what Judge Gordon found, that it was, I assume you're talking about 614?
Yes.
That it was preempted.
And Gordon, he has found it. And we're not bound by that. And in fact, we've appealed that to the Ninth Circuit, and that's still in front of the Ninth Circuit today. The Nevada legislature had a right to protect its citizens. And the simple protection was something that really only made common sense. That before a CBA goes into effect, it should be provided to the membership in writing, provided at a meeting, and the members have right to vote on it. Now you would think that would go without saying. And in fact, when we had Mr. Youngmark, who flew in from the USW from Pittsburgh, he flew in and began negotiating on behalf of the union when the members had through with a 98% vote, denied or refused to ratify the first, last, final, and best offer. He testified at the hearing before the referee that in his 17 years, there had only been two occasions where he had signed a CBA without there being a vote. A vote of the Lincoln file, a vote of the membership, without it even being presented to the membership. One of those occasions was that the particular local union was in bankruptcy. Another occasion was when basically the union was no longer functioning. So in no occasion where you had an actively functioning union had the USW or Mr. Youngmark in 17 years simply circumvented the negotiating process and signed the CBA. Here at that time, there were members, rank and file members, including Mr. Tesla, who were voted on to the negotiating committee. They had been negotiating in good faith with the employer. They found out just through some correspondence that the CBA had been signed. Mr. Youngmark didn't even bother to call the members of the negotiating committee when he signed the CBA and then got on a plane and left the next day. So, are those union members reasonable in their good faith belief that the Nevada statute, which was in effect at that time and is still in effect today, is reasonable for them to believe that that statute, as it's written since it was violated, that there was no collective bargaining, that it voided the actions of Mr. Youngmark?
So let me ask you this in that regard. Same question I asked opposing counsel. if you've got a grievance with your union or your union representative, what's your recourse? Did you file a grievance?
That's one recourse, is to file a grievance.
Okay, and then why is that not a better way to go?
It might have been a better way.
Deciding you're going to do a wildcat strike if that's what you want to call it.
But what has to be decided right now, though, Your Honor, in determining whether there's unemployment benefits is not whether the issues regarding the NLRB or the NLRA. It's whether these 240 members, 240 drivers, had a good faith, reasonable belief that the statute was in effect, and therefore, that CBA was void.
But then they were peppered with letters from the union saying it's illegal, and the other statutes on the books regarding misconduct and what constitutes a labor dispute. The statutes were there as well.
And your Honor, what constitutes a labor dispute? First of all, they were not peppered with letters.
Actually, there were three in a very short.
There were three letters.
Yes.
One of those, I think, only one of those letters was prior to the protests they had on the strip on March 29th. I believe the others were after that time. Secondly, none of those letters were written by lawyers. They were written by union officials, one of which, who was the culprit in here, Mr. Youngmark, who just signed the collective bargaining agreement in violation of the statute, which said that it should be printed and submitted to the members for ratification. So the union didn't have lawyers giving a reasoned opinion in the letter they sent to their members. I think there were three letters all total. None of them were written by a lawyer. None of them were giving a legal opinion. They were just giving the opinion of some high-ranking officials of the union itself. Well, the question becomes, was their action reason? Because if their action is reason, it's a reasonable belief that a statute, in reading its plain language, has been violated, that there's no collective bargaining agreement. So if there's no collective bargaining agreement, then you have nothing you're violating by having a protest, which the employer then terminated you based on the collective bargaining agreement. They didn't terminate them for the protest that they had. They terminated them for allegedly violating the collective bargaining agreement. But if you look at Article 5 of that collective bargaining agreement, Section 3 of it specifically says what the union itself should not do, is prohibited from doing, and what individual members of the union are prohibited from doing. But the section that they're talking about regarding the strike only says the union can't strike. It's very specific language, it's very detailed language. It prohibits the union. It does not prohibit the individual from exercising their right to protest. In this particular instance, they were right in protesting. It's shocking to think that you would have, and in fact, Mr. Youngmark, in 17 years, had never just signed a collective bargaining agreement without having the rank and file have a chance to review it and have a chance to ratify it, or even not ratify it. He simply believed that, as he testified, that there was a silent majority that would be overruled by the other members. Of course, that goes against the statistics, since there were 1,200 members, and only when 700 voted at a meeting, over 680 voted against the particular last, final, and best offer. Again, Your Honor, there was no misconduct. Now, let's start with the issue of labor dispute. Was this a labor dispute? There's been talk about airport casino. Even in airport casino, it was a union-authorized action. They have cited no cases where there has been action by the members that was not the union-authorized action that were considered a labor dispute. All the cases we've discussed have been labor disputes, action authorized by the union, either actions to strike, actions to honor a picket line, actions in one way or another by the union itself. So, this was not considered a labor dispute within the meaning of our unemployment benefits statute. Because we're not talking about the National Labor Relations Act, we're just talking about Nevada's right to pay benefits to its workers if they are unemployed.
Well, sir, let me just inquire. If this court were to determine that the Wildcat strike at issue here constituted a labor action and should perhaps be analyzed under 395, can it still be analyzed under 385? Can that same conduct, if it's determined to be a labor dispute, still be characterized as misconduct and subject to that analysis?
Well, and because it's two different determinations. First of all, you determine whether or not the actions by the employer of termination is for misconduct, but that's separate from determining actions under 385 and under 395. If there is a labor dispute, then we don't get into the misconduct. Now, if there's misconduct, we have to do the analysis of misconduct in 395 as to whether or not there was a wrongfulness element, whether they were doing something wrong.
I'm sorry, because I don't know when I'm going to get cut off. So is your position that it's not a labor dispute, it should be under the misconduct statute, but I think item 3 would apply?
Well, yes. Yes.
I just want to be clear.
Yes, because, and that is what the referee decided, that's what the board of review decided, and it's simply because there was no union action. There was no negotiation. To be a labor dispute, there's negotiations after the dispute. There was no negotiations after dispute. It didn't meet the five criteria set forth by the referee and adopted by the board of review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court thanks all four attorneys for the final argument in this matter. The briefs on this case is submitted, and we'll be in recess till the next call of court.